Welcome. This podcast series is brought to you by the Midwest Pain Society. I'm Dr. Benjamin Gill, a PM&R resident at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri.
And I'm Edward Pingino, a medical student at Kansas City University who is very interested in learning more about pain and how we can help patients with pain.
We will be your co-hosts for today's episode. In this third episode of our series, Chronic Pain, a Silent Epidemic, we will focus on the causes of chronic pain. Our guest for this episode, as we will introduce shortly, is a pediatric pain psychologist. This will facilitate our discussion of pain in the pediatric population and causes of pain from a developmental context. Edward, as we get started, I would like to give a quick review of the magnitude of pain in the United States. The CDC periodically releases analyses on the prevalence of chronic pain throughout the country. Based on data from the 2016 National Health Interview Survey, an estimated 20.4% of U.S. adults, or 50 million individuals, suffered with chronic pain, and 8%, or 19.6 million adults, had high-impact chronic pain.
Wow, those are some serious numbers.
Absolutely. While the NHIS does not collect data on chronic pain or high-impact chronic pain in children specifically, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services estimates that chronic pain may affect 5 to 38% of children and adolescents. The WHO has emphasized that pain in children is a public health concern of major significance in most parts of the world. For many children, this pain is chronic. Chronic pain is experienced by about a quarter to a third of children, with about 1 in 20 experiencing debilitating pain. As the leading cause of morbidity in children and adolescents in the world today, chronic pain is a major health concern.
Most definitely. Now, I recognize that adults often will suffer with chronic pain as a result of an underlying disease or health condition, injury, medical treatment such as surgery, inflammation, or a problem in the nervous system. And as you discussed in the last episode, the actual cause may also be unknown.
That's correct.
As for pediatric conditions, some diseases predispose to chronic pain. For example, congenital diseases such as sickle cell disease may develop pain in the infant or toddler period. There are also non-congenital diseases like juvenile idiopathic arthritis, fibromyalgia, inflammatory bowel disease, or primary chronic pain conditions like headaches, chronic abdominal pain, chronic musculoskeletal pain, and CRPS.
Absolutely. You know, that's kind of similar to what I see in the adult population as well. We need to recognize the origin of pain conditions in the pediatric age group because the developing pediatric nervous system can be especially vulnerable to pain sensitization and development of neuroplasticity. Data support the finding that early neonatal and childhood pain experiences can alter pain sensitivity in later life. Poor pain management in children can put them at risk for persistent pain and increased impairment as they transition into adulthood, and may even be linked to the development of new chronic pain conditions.
Very important point. Let's delve a little deeper into populations that are at risk for chronic pain. For example, in adults, there are higher prevalences of both chronic pain and high-impact chronic pain reported among women, older adults, previously but not currently employed adults, adults living in poverty, military veterans, adults with public health insurance, and rural residents. In the pediatric population, a variety of risk factors have been found to be associated with chronic pain in youth. The greatest amount of evidence appears to support that temperament, anxiety, depression, subjective experience of stress, passive coping strategies, sleep problems, other somatic-related problems, and parent and/or family factors that are important variables. However, a great deal of this research focuses on a single risk factor or on multiple risk factors in isolation. Much of the literature utilizes older diagnostic criteria and would benefit from replication, larger sample sizes, and comparison across pain disorders. Problems also exist with disagreement across definitions, resulting in inconsistency or unclear use of terms. Furthermore, recent consideration has suggested that outcome measures should include functional disability in addition to pain.
Well, Edward, I'm glad we were able to review some of the facts and statistics out there. I think the best thing we could do at this point, though, is introduce our guest and kind of hear from her everyday experience. Today, we've got Dr. Emily Foxenkraft. As I mentioned, she's a clinical psychologist focused specifically with pediatrics. She's an assistant professor in the Division of Pediatric Psychology at University of Michigan. She also serves on the membership committee here with us of the Midwest Pain Society. We are grateful that she was willing to share her time and expertise with us. Dr. Foxencraft, would you please give us a brief biography regarding your training, interests, and current role?
Well, thank you for having me. Happy to be here. My current role involves providing treatment to children and adolescents with chronic pain, conducting research to improve our understanding of pediatric chronic pain and our treatment options, and educating psychology and medical trainees in this field. In our clinic, I provide care through our intensive outpatient rehabilitation program, and I also see a lot of pediatric patients with headache and migraine. I also co-lead a tele-mentoring program for pediatricians in Michigan regarding headache management.
Dr. Foxencraft, that is a fantastic resume, and we're so glad that you could join us today. You have extensive experience both in research and in clinical practice. Tell us a little bit more about your day-to-day with what you do now.
Sure. So I'm heavily involved in research, which means I'm working on designing and implementing many research studies to focus on improving our treatments. As a clinical psychologist, I am working with children on a day-to-day basis and teens and young adults, like I said, working on functional rehabilitation with chronic pain. So I work in a variety of different clinics where I work one-on-one with kids or in group settings. We have kids coming in for as little as, you know, one therapy session a week, all the way up to very intensive treatment programs, depending on their needs. And what I'm starting to learn is that we don't always have a great idea about who needs what. How can I tell if somebody needs something less intense or more intense beyond what they tell me they think they need and what I can judge clinically? So that's what my research is starting to focus on, is how can we get more precise and more individualized? So that's what I do on a day-to-day basis.
That's fascinating. Thank you so much. Now, as a physician here, I have the opportunity frequently in nearly all of my patients to directly refer or suggest that they go see a psychologist. Before we kind of dive into our discussion about pediatrics, I want to make sure we have a good understanding. What is the difference, in your case specifically, of a pain psychologist versus any other type of psychology that you might encounter?
A pain psychologist is somebody who spent some time training in the field of pediatric pain psychology, or pain psychology, more broadly speaking, and really helps individuals focus on managing their pain as well as functional rehabilitation. So the goals are usually focused more on pain versus maybe some more broader goals that someone might have when working with a more general practitioner. Kind of the same way you might have a specialist with your medical health and maybe a primary care physician who takes care of some of your broader needs. So that's some of the differences you might encounter. Pain psychologists often use evidence-based approaches like cognitive behavioral therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, therapies that focus more on behaviors and solutions. And there's a wide variety of treatments, like I've said, but a pain psychologist will be more focused on some of those pain-related goals. May I add that a pain psychologist will also hopefully be working with patients' physicians and medical team in an integrated fashion.
Absolutely, as it should be. Now, we're talking about who develops chronic pain, and we want to focus specifically on pediatrics as much as we can in this case. Can you tell us a little bit about common presentations of the patients that are coming in?
Sure. Like we said, pediatric chronic pain is much more common than people may think, a quarter to even a third of kids. But because people don't know about it, those who develop chronic pain can be misunderstood for a long time until they get the right treatment. In kids, more common pain presentations are headache and migraine, abdominal pain, regional or more widespread musculoskeletal pain, for example, conditions like CRPS, complex regional pain syndrome, and AMPS, amplified musculoskeletal pain syndrome.
That's very interesting. Dr. Foxencraft, how is chronic pain in children different from chronic pain in adults?
Also a great question, and this is really important that we think about this a little bit more. What we know about chronic pain often comes from research done in adults, because as we said, it's taken people a while to recognize that this is an issue with kids. But kids are not just teeny adults. Children's nervous systems are still developing and their lives are in a lot of flux. However, many adults actually report that their pain began in childhood. So it may be helpful to think about chronic pain across the lifespan spectrum rather than adult versus pediatric chronic pain being two completely different entities.
That's tremendously insightful and makes a lot of sense. Could you please tell us a little bit about the pathophysiology of pediatric chronic pain?
Well, what we are discovering is that pain in adults, like pain in adults, the pathophysiology of pediatric chronic pain is similarly complex. It involves integrated changes in brain regions and the connectivity between them, spinal and peripheral processes. Pediatric chronic pain cannot be reduced to only physical or even only psychological phenomena. And that's why interdisciplinary evaluation and multimodal treatment is crucial for helping kids get better. Like adults, kids can have pain from different mechanisms, like nociplastic peripheral, neuropathic, and centralized or nociplastic pain, which would then lead to different treatments.
Such important things to consider. Could you please tell us a little bit more about why children develop chronic pain?
Unfortunately, there's no one reason why children develop chronic pain. Like you said, there are known risk factors, some of the most identified ones being female, older, or experiencing trauma or stress. A study by actually some of my colleagues at the University of Michigan's Chronic Pain and Fatigue Research Center, led by Chelsea Kaplan, identified that there are even brain patterns in healthy children that predicted the development of multi-site pain 1 year later. We think genetics or learning may have something to do with this because sometimes chronic pain seems to run in families. Puberty also seems to play a major role because prevalence of pediatric chronic pain shifts around that time period. Some children's pain begins with an injury or surgery. Many children with chronic pain report high levels of stress and mood concerns, and that could be a causal mechanism, or it could be a symptom of the chronic pain condition, or even a consequence of having pain. And the tricky part is, once one or multiple factors are present, they can then exacerbate one another in a self-perpetuating, really vicious cycle. So for instance, you know, if you're having a bad night's sleep, you might have more pain the next day and feel more anxious and off, but then that pain and anxiety can lead you to have bad sleep the next night. So there's really a lot to learn. And understanding pain through this biopsychosocial lens is really critical for improving our understanding of pain mechanisms and may help us better assess and treat pediatric chronic pain.
That is tremendously intriguing, but it's also very critical to think about pain in this way as multiple factors and variables that work together overall to contribute toward one's experience with pain. Dr. Foxencraft, what would you say is the ideal team approach for a pediatric patient with chronic pain?
Well, that's exactly it. It really should be a team. A good evaluation for chronic pain should usually involve some sort of interdisciplinary evaluation. That means providers from different specialties, like a physician, a psychologist, and people like physical therapists and others. It's important to make sure that the mechanism of pain is well understood for this evaluation so that the right kind of treatment can be recommended, as well as ensuring that other needs are taken care of. With children, it's really important too to be thoughtful in how you ask about the pain. Clinicians, whether they're physicians, psychologists, physical therapists, should be aware of the different measures that are appropriate for children of different ages. And they should be attentive to caregivers, who should be thinking about not just verbalizations of pain, but other behavioral signs.
Now, we've previously touched on the recognition of costs in the treatment of chronic pain around the world and the United States. How does that tend to play out in the pediatric population?
Well, pediatric pain can be really expensive. Recent estimates put it at $19.5 billion annually in the United States. But this includes things like costly medical tests, inpatient stays, caregivers' lost work time, and rehabilitation. Recent research breaking down these costs highlighted how much of these costs really are driven by ER visits and specialty care, and highlighted how it might be possible to reduce these costs by focusing on rehabilitation. Interdisciplinary rehabilitation has been associated with reducing tens of thousands of dollars per patient per year for hospitals and insurance companies.
Now, we've talked about the need for a team approach, and we've talked a little bit about some of the evaluation that you do. But as far as your treatment, how's that going to play out in the pediatric population?
The treatment for pediatric chronic pain has a great emphasis on non-pharmacological pain management and rehabilitation, which can be complemented by medication management. Treatment should match the functional concerns of the child or teen, and should really focus on this overall functional rehabilitation, which means working towards getting them back to their lives. Many programs, including ours, incorporates things like physical therapy and pain psychology. Like I mentioned, we have a range of intensities in our treatment, but they all focus on gradually getting kids back to the areas of their daily lives that may have been impacted by having chronic pain, often school or sports. We do this by getting kids moving with a focus on consistent aerobic physical activity and pairing them with pain coping strategies like relaxation, problem solving, and changing how we think and act around pain. In kids, we have to think about their context within their family, school, and peers and incorporate them as much as possible too. Sometimes teachers or family members have really strong opinions about how things should be handled. And with kids, it's important to understand that they are individuals in the context of their own development. They're working on their own identities, values, relationships, goals, and thought processes. When working with anyone, kids or adults, it's really important to meet them where they're at and then help them grow on their own path.
I absolutely love this focus on person-specific, individualized medicine, and am such an advocate for that approach when it comes to utilizing any treatment modality. When it comes to pharmacologic treatments, could you please tell us a little bit about what options are available there?
Sure. And of course, I want to be cautious when I'm making any recommendations because I am not a prescribing physician. But from what we understand working together as a team and what we understand from the research, pharmacological treatment in pediatric chronic pain should really be thought of as a complement to the non-pharmacological treatment and really be targeted towards aiming to facilitate the process of rehabilitation rather than replacing it. So for some children, adding a medication that might allow them to move through their process of rehabilitation a little bit better might be a good fit. Medication providers should consider things perhaps that target the nervous system or are thought to target the nervous system, like gabapentin, or antidepressants such as amitriptyline and nortriptyline.
And certainly in my experience as a prescriber, I see a tendency to avoid certain agents as well.
Absolutely. So if pain is chronic, we really should be thinking about avoiding opioids as well as frequent over-the-counter medication uses like acetaminophen or ibuprofen.
Well, that's certainly interesting. Dr. Foxencraft, would you mind sharing why we might want to avoid some of these agents?
Sure. Well, that is a huge topic in and of itself, and many experts can speak to this topic more thoroughly. But what we are starting to understand is that opioids should really not be thought of for something for long-term use, and if pain is chronic, that really does not fit that category. In fact, over-reliance on opioids can have many different adverse effects, like actually causing hyperalgesia, which is more sensitization and increases in pain, as well as a number of adverse other physical and emotional outcomes.
And certainly that's rough enough in adulthood. It's not something I want to delve into in childhood. So,
fortunately, I think we see that many pediatric providers have been learning about this. And at least in our clinic, we see very few kids who have been using opioids on a long-term basis.
Now, we've been talking about this idea of who develops chronic pain. And we're talking about pediatrics. As far as the prognosis of pediatric pain and its carryover into adulthood, can you speak on that a little bit more?
Sure. Well, like I mentioned, many children, adults today, say that they've had pain since childhood. So that could leave parents and providers for children today feeling a little discouraged. But I think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic. Kids today who get access to these new kinds of interdisciplinary treatments that we've been talking about today that really focus on functional rehabilitation can have really positive outcomes. But then again, it kind of depends on how you define positive outcomes or success. Is success the complete absence of any pain? Is it more improving your life, like being able to return to school, sports, or meaningful activities? One study did find that 58% of those who graduated from an intensive interdisciplinary pain treatment program were pain-free about 7 years later, but they also had better coping strategies and improved autonomy. These programs are not one-size-fits-all approach. Kids and families really have to be ready to work hard towards their goals if they want to see any of these definitions of success.
What would you say is one of the most exciting or current hot topics in pediatric pain as far as research and discussion?
Yeah, I think Some interesting areas is this, like I hinted at, precision treatment. I think we've come to the state in the field where we have so many evidence-based techniques like CBT, physical therapy, ACT, you know, you have all these like different techniques that are proven effective, at least against a placebo or a weightless control or against each other sometimes, but we don't know maybe who responds better to which different kinds. So I think that's something that's being looked at. There's still work to do in the area of measurement. People are still working on like using e-health and measurement tools and, you know, using mobile technology to really get in, you know, especially with kids and teenagers, they're a great audience for testing out innovative.
Oh, most definitely. That's so interesting. Dr. Foxencraft, are there any resources that you might recommend to our listeners?
Sure. There are a number of great books for parents of kids with chronic pain. And maybe we can put them in some sort of show notes or on our website. There's a great one by Emily Law and Tanya Palermo. There is a great one by Rachel Coakley from Boston Children's and from Lonnie Zeltzer. So there's some great books for parents. We recently in our field have a new workbook for teenagers that might be great, but that's usually best paired with working with a therapist. And there's some great videos and stuff out there too. There's a great website out of Australia called Pain Bites. The Bites is spelled with a Y. And that's a great website because it's broken up into a lot of different modules. So you don't have a lot of text at once. And most of the modules are paired with a video. And the video is a child or teenager explaining about their chronic pain or how they use a specific technique. So it can be really relatable. And what I would caution people is not to go on WebMD and to be cautious about stories you hear on the internet because sometimes those can be a little skewed or personal to one person's experience.
Are there any other big organizations that you participate in outside of Midwest Pain Society?
Sure. I am part of the Michigan Psychological Association, which is how I got connected with the Midwest Pain Society. We have a task force where we're putting on grand rounds and about pain to our state. I'm also a member of the Society of Pediatric Psychology, which is a group of psychologists across all different areas of health for pediatrics. So that's been a really exciting group to be a part of. So there's a large contingent of pain psychologists, but also psychologists who work in diabetes management and obesity and sickle cell and all different other kinds of health-related conditions and concerns. So we have, you know, a lot of cross-cutting issues about interdisciplinary work and working, you know, in a healthcare field. And I'm also was involved in the American Pain Society and looking forward to being involved in that new iteration. And I'm hoping to attend the International Association for the Study of Pain, it's their conference.
Pediatric pain, in general, may be an overlooked situation, at least among adult providers, and really trying to recognize that there are things we need to do before transitioning into adulthood. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us before we wrap up?
Well, we've really come a long way with pediatric pain management. Many kids and parents feel really lost and alone when they have pain, like they've lost their lives. But we want you to know that they're not alone. You are not alone. Now that we've recognized it better, we've developed effective evidence-based interventions that really can make a difference. When kids and their caregivers partner with their providers, they can work towards their goals, focused on their own priorities, and really grow and thrive.
Well, this has been a fantastic episode, truly insightful and helpful. Dr. Foxencraft, thank you for your time and for sharing some of your expertise with us and helping us learn a little bit more about pediatric chronic pain. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of our series, Chronic Pain, A Silent Epidemic. If you are interested in learning more about the Midwest Pain Society, please visit us on our website at midwestpainsociety.org. Until next time.